You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. I'm delighted to welcome you all to the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace for what is a very exciting occasion for us, which is the publication and the release of Rajamohan's new book on Sino-Indian naval interactions in the Indian Ocean. Everyone who follows issues pertaining to Asia appreciates the fact that the trajectories that China and India take in the next few decades will be critical not only for what happens between the two countries, but also for peace and stability in the continent itself. And yet, the conventional wisdom when we think of China and India is a conventional wisdom that is driven largely by the perceptions of what happens across their terrestrial frontiers. It's the history of China and India in the context of Tibet. It's the history of China and India in the context of their land competition, the relations between the two countries in the nuclear realm, which at least until now have been substantially in the landward realm. These are the kinds of dimensions that capture people's attention when we think of China and India and their strategic interactions. And yet, it is becoming increasingly obvious that there are new dimensions that are being added to the interaction between these two countries. Space is one that has received comparatively less attention. Cyber is another, which is only beginning to get the attention in India particularly now. But there is an entirely different realm, the realm of the oceans, which is now beginning to grow in attention both in China and India. And so we are really at the earliest phases of trying to understand what Sino-Indian interactions, let alone rivalry, would look like in the Indian Ocean. And it has really been our privilege to be able to publish what I think is the first book-length study that seriously attempts to examine Sino-Indian maritime interactions in their totality. Not simply the dimensions relating to naval competition, but embedding what happens in the realm of naval interactions in the larger movements of geopolitics, in the larger interactions involving trade and commerce, and of course, the ever-present relationship that each of these two countries has with the United States. And Raja has done a superb job of telling a story at a level that even those who are not particularly experts in this field or follow these issues closely can actually read with profit. We have in the sheets that we have left, I think, for you, biographic introductions to the two speakers we have this afternoon. I'm not going to repeat the biographical detail that has already been provided to you in the invitations, except to say one thing about each of the two gentlemen that we have at the table. Let me start with Raja. Raja is simply said India's foremost strategic analyst in my book and in the perception of many. He was a student of the late Dr. K. Subramaniam, who is widely acknowledged as the doyen of India's strategic thinkers. And Raja has brought to the trade not simply an intimate knowledge of international relations and geopolitics, but actually the training of a physicist, although I suspect he would wish to forget the years that he spent at JNU doing physics. But he's someone who is intimately aware of the technical dimensions of military competition and the like. And so it is a particular particular delight for us to be able to welcome Raja back to the endowment for the release of this book. The other person I have a very special regard for, and I want to extend a very special welcome to, is Admiral Mike McDivitt. Mike spent many decades in the service of his country in the U.S. Navy. And after retiring from the Navy, he went to the Center for Naval Analysis, where he actually built up what I think is one of the best programs in the city that looks very seriously at issues of strategic competition in the Asia Pacific. And this program, unfortunately for us, has put out fewer products in the public realm, but has done an enormous job of educating US policymakers through a variety of very detailed reports that explain to US policymakers what the emerging environment in the broader Indo-Pacific looks like. And without going into extraordinary detail, I'll just tell you that the range of publications that have been put out of this Asia Strategy Program start with geopolitics at one end, looking at the big picture, looks at issues relating to trade and maritime security, all the way to the in-the-weeds issues relating to sea control and war fighting in the contingencies that the United States may one day face in this part of the world. So having Mike McDivitt with us this afternoon is particularly advantageous, because he is someone who can not only speak to these issues from the vantage point of everything that he learned in his professional career, but because he literally spent the last decade studying very closely these issues from a policy perspective. Mike knows the Indo-Pacific like I suspect he knows his mother's kitchen. So it's wonderful to have Mike serve.
Hyperbole is running rampant here.
All well-meant and all well-deserved. But it's great to have Mike with us. He will speak for about 10 or 15 minutes after Raja outlines the broad thesis of the book. And then we will open the floor to an interaction with both the scholars we have today. So let me thank you all for coming here, and a very warm welcome to Raja and to Mike. Thank you.
I think I'm speaking from here.
Thank you, Ashley. Thank you for that generous introduction. As they say, if my wife was here, she would have loved it, and my mom would have believed it. So which is really, thank you. Thank you, Ashley. Thank you for the whole team. Ed Carnegie for making this book possible. I also wanted to thank Admiral McDivitt because he was one of the reviewers of this manuscript and gave very useful suggestions for improving and shaping that book into the present form. What I thought I'll do is really to begin and explain the title a little bit, the three parts to the title. One is the main title of the book is Samudra Manthan. Samudra Manthan, as you no, it's one of the major Indian fables. Those of you who've been to Southeast Asia, to Cambodia, to Angkor Wat, you'd see much of the cosmology of Angkor Wat is built around this theme. So if you're looking at the future maritime politics of the Indian Ocean and the Pacific, you thought this is a good fable to invoke, to see the extraordinary transformation that I think China and India are going to bring to these two great oceans. Second, I think the fable is also as a way of framing the, shall we say, the triangular problem, the trilateral or triangular dynamic that exists in these two oceans. So one is the nature of the India-China rivalry, how that's going to shape America's policies and is going to be shaped by what the U.S. does. So if in the fable, of course, the Lord Vishnu tries to regulate the competition between the demons and the angels, and eventually manipulates it in favor of one side. But in trying to do that, of course, he has to do a lot of tricks. He has to perform many tricks, and in the process, he himself partly gets transformed. So I think that in that sense, that fable of how the churning in this great oceans is going to be influenced, I thought is too good a story to miss when talking about the India-China competition in the Indo-Pacific and the U.S. role there. The second part of it is the use of the term Indo-Pacific. It's already gained some traction in the last few years. I mean, some of the think tanks in Washington are already beginning to use it, and the Australians have made it into a very major way of framing their, because they're out there between the two oceans. So I think my argument here is that how we think about geopolitics or geographies is not what the geography teacher tells us in school. But I think the imagined geographies keep changing depending on the circumstance. For example, the word Southeast Asia was not used till Lord Mountbatten had his troops to go out and throw out the Japanese from Southeast Asia. And terms like Middle East, West Asia, Central Asia, Greater Middle East, Inner Asia, all these terms tend to emerge in a particular context, and they're not fixed geographies. And I think one of the great consequences of the rise of China and the slower emergence of India is that the fusing of these two oceans, the politics, the security politics of these two oceans is going to be fused. And I think that is the idea behind why we mention use the term Indo-Pacific here. Because I think the rise of China is going to come into the Indian Ocean. It's on its way. Similarly, India is showing its flag today in the Pacific. And I think India's interests in the Pacific are also growing. So it's important to see these two oceans together, that it is not, as admirals will tell you, the water is always connected. It's not the oceans are one. But I think in strategic understanding, a time has come to see these two regions and littorals are together. The third aspect of the title about rivalry, about India-China rivalry. Of course, if you listen to Delhi or China, Beijing these days, I mean, you won't hear that word. You know, how we Orientals are, you know, we tend to be roundabout, that when we actually talking about friendship, brotherhood, solidarity, that's not exactly what we mean. But the fact is, while India-China relationship has actually improved and there are many things are going on, but rivalry has been a very defining element of the last 60 years. But what has changed, of course, is the stakes in this relationship have grown. And the rivalry, as Ashley pointed out, has begun to move from the Great Himalayas to the waters of the Indian Ocean and the Pacific. So I think the problem is here of this, how do we deal with this rivalry? Because the tendency in Asian states is to deny the existence of a problem, not to talk about it. But the fact is, a rivalry, I think, is unfolding in the Indo-Pacific. And the challenges for India and China is, how do you mitigate some of the worst consequences of this rivalry? And what role does the United States play in that? So though that is the third theme of that book, and that's how we have the title Samudra Manthan, the Sino-Indian Rivalry in the Indo-Pacific. What I do in the book is to lay out start with the history of the modern Sino-Indian relationship and how every single attempt in the last 80 years. I mean, the first contacts between Indian nationalists and the Chinese nationalists go back to the 1920s when they were meeting at these anti-imperial congresses in Brussels and other great European cities. Since then, there have been repeated attempts at structuring a brotherhood of sorts, of Asian brotherhood, of anti-colonial solidarity. Repeated attempts were made through history in the last 80 years. But each time, there was something or the other which intervenes to prevent India and China from being real partners. This time, I think, as this maritime rivalry unfolds, the challenge is going to be much more tougher, even as the nature of the relationship between India and China has evolved, which has today much more solidity, much more economic content than there ever was. And I think that is a significant change that has taken place. But the rivalrous nature of the relationship has not disappeared. So the question is not to deny its existence, not to pretend it doesn't exist, but to confront the sources of this rivalry in the maritime domain and trying to find ways to deal with it. What I argue in this book is that China and India are now destined to become maritime powers. And their turn to the sea is a historic change in their own evolution as states. Of course, any number of nationalist historians in China and India will tell you, we've always been maritime powers. There's Chang He who came to the Indian Ocean. There was Rajaraja Chola who kind of raided Southeast Asia sitting from east coast of South India. So there has been historically maritime activity. But never have India and China been committed as they are today to embark onto an adventure into the sea. Because both empires, the great empires that came up in China and India, both were preoccupied with land-based threats. And it's only that most of their energy went into coping with the threats from the land. both in this, interestingly, in both countries from the northwestern direction. And it's only now that they're turning to the sea. And that, I think, is rooted firmly in the nature of the new economies. The globalization of the Chinese and the Indian economies today have made both these countries have generated an extraordinary interdependence between China, India, and the rest of the world. The per capita, India's GDP today, more than 40% is linked to imports and exports. And China, of course, the size of the Chinese trade is dramatic. So what I'm arguing is that both China and India are turning to the seas. And like many great trading nations before them, they are going to build blue water navies. That we don't have to attribute motives to the Chinese or to the Indians of some kind of a malefied intention, but I think it's very much in the structure of their economies. And they're basically doing what all the great powers before them did. When Britain became a trading nation, it became a maritime power, so did the United States. And I think what China and India are doing is essentially pursuing the same logic, that as their economies globalize, as the interests go beyond their immediate periphery and become global, that to pursue those interests, to be able to secure those interests on their own, they are going to build a modern, big navies, and navies that are blue water capabilities that go with it. And here, that as they turn to the oceans, it's also going to raise interesting questions. Because in both countries, there's a lot of the third world rhetoric, you know. We don't like foreign bases. We don't want, you know, if only the Americans leave the Indian Ocean, we'll all be living happily ever after. Or the Chinese might say, if only the Americans leave the Pacific, you know, everybody will be brothers and sisters in that part of the world. Now, that kind of a rhetoric, I mean, it's fine. I mean, that's what we come with, that baggage. But I think the fact is that if you look at the debates closely, both in China and India, the China and India, I think by logic of the new circumstance, are most likely to do, or at least have begun to debate, what other great powers have done before them, which is look for foreign bases, consider use of force beyond their territory. If you look at the Libyan crisis, the Chinese Navy and the Indian Navy, Chinese Navy evacuated 30,000 Chinese workers, the Indian Navy evacuated 20,000 workers. The Chinese Navy, for the first time, came to Mediterranean. The Indian Navy, too, had been there before, but the Indian Navy was doing the same. So I think that given the changing nature of their interests, which are rooted in the changing nature of their economy, I think the logic of how China and India are going to debate their international policies, which means cultivating special relationships, cultivating partnerships, is not merely gaining access to not only oil, but in the Indian case, we also have to get access to coal, because India is going to import tons and tons of coal from every corner of the world. That if you're, just as the U.S. defines its naval interests in terms of its vital interests spread around the world, so in the same manner, China and India's interests across the world, securing their access to resources and markets, and of securing their interests requires a different strategic orientation. And I think what we're seeing in both China and India is the first stages of defining this new approach, which is linked to the new maritime interests that they have around the world. The one substantive part of the book deals with China's turn to the Indian Ocean, and India's turn to the Pacific Ocean. Now, the Chinese case, I think, whatever might be the Indian concerns at the popular level, at least at the systemic level, at the establishment level, is quite clearly understood why the Chinese are coming to the Indian Ocean. That today they're dependent on the Gulf resources, they're dependent on Africa for mineral resources. So I think, just as all the other great powers came to the Indian Ocean before, starting with the Portuguese, the Dutch, the British, the French, the Americans, that it's a matter of time the Chinese, too, are going to come as the stakes rise in the Indian Ocean. So it's not a matter of evil intentions, but I think it's in the logic of Chinese interests and how they've grown in the Indian Ocean. And the only difference being the Western powers came from the West, and the first Eastern maritime power is going to come from the East into the Indian Ocean. So I think it is a realist approach of understanding what China's interests in the Indian Ocean are and why China is going to come into the Indian Ocean. Similarly, in the case of Indian case, the Indian interest in the Pacific is largely not usually stated, but the fact is that it was the Indian troops which actually pushed the Japanese. When people talk about the Britain and the Allies pushing the Japanese out of Southeast Asia, it was actually the Indian troops, the undivided India. 1 million Indian troops participated in the Second World War. I don't think it's 2, but I think it's somewhere between 1 and 1.2. It's in the Burmese operation, in the Eastern Theater. To be exact, it was 750,000 Indian troops who participated, the undivided India's troops, who participated in the Mountbatten's Southeast Asia Command and took the liberation of these regions from Japan in Rangoon, in Singapore, in Jakarta, in Hanoi. It was the Indian troops that took the surrender from the Japanese troops. This history, because of peculiar political context in India, we don't talk about it, but the fact is that India's intervention, India's role in the Pacific, and in the colonial period, was fairly strong one. In fact, the other day I was looking at the records, the first Indian expeditionary operation under the British Raj was in 1762, when a small detachment was sent from Chennai, Madras in those days, to Philippines to go and reach out and bash up a few people, like what the U.S. does these days. That the expedition, and the Chinese will tell you that the Indian Army was repeatedly involved in dealing with the opium wars. When you talk about the British control of China during the opium wars, it was the Indian troops that actually participated. One is not justifying or claiming credit for any of these, but the fact is the nature of the interaction of India with the Pacific is a fairly significant one and a historic one. And what brings it back today is the rise and emergence of India as a large economy with growing interests and with significant capabilities as and when it develops them, then a role in the Pacific, I think, is going to happen inevitably in the coming years. And as China comes into the Indian Ocean, India looks to the Pacific, one of the interesting things that we see happening in the Indian Ocean is the focus on the island states. That suddenly you find, islands, for those admirals for islands are always important, that for any maritime strategy, gaining access to critically located islands, as Mahan talks about it long ago, that islands that are sitting on the Great Sea Lanes are critical, and it's because of the American extraordinary power in the last many years that some of this classical emphasis on geopolitics might have gone down, but the U.S. presence in the Indian Ocean is still premised on having access to Digogashia. Similarly, what you see today is the Chinese interest in cultivating special relationships with a few important island states in the Indian Ocean. These include Sri Lanka, Maldives, Seychelles, and Mauritius. And Seychelles now has offered some kind of a facility for the Chinese for relief and resupply. We don't call it bases. It's not politically incorrect. But the fact is, the Seychellois were not shy of announcing them. But the fact is that these island states, which sit across critical sea lanes in the Indian Ocean, have become the object of significant interest from the Chinese. And India, of course, had historically good relations and protectorate relationships with these island states. And now India is trying to consolidate its own position. And that's where the some kind of a competition that has emerged between India and China for the favors from these island states in the Indian Ocean. Of course, if you look at the Pacific, all the struggle is today about island states. The strategy there is defined in terms of first island chain, the second island chain. It's all about islands, and some of them are not even islands, some simply rocks. But the fact is that if you look at the geography of the waters, gaining access to these islands has become central to the new geopolitics of the Indo-Pacific. And I think some of that play, which is direct and in your face today in the Pacific, is also beginning to happen in the Indian Ocean to a lesser extent. Then if you look at the larger contest that is taking place between India and China in the littorals of the Indian Ocean and the Pacific, that if in my book I take three sub-regions of this Indo-Pacific. I take the Arabian Sea and the Gulf, then I take the Bay of Bengal, and I take the South China Sea. In all three, you see a significant changes in the way India and China are beginning to operate in this part of the world. India has, of course, had historic relationship with the Gulf states, but largely neglected them in the last post-independence period. But today, India is reviving many of the historic defense relationships in the Gulf and strengthening its own position. Similarly, the Chinese today, since December 2008, they've been operating in the Gulf of Aden. They're beginning to reach out to many states in the Gulf, and the Navy is regular now. For example, in Oman, which is a good friend of India, the Chinese ships have called there at least 25 times in the last 3 years. regular port calls at Salalah, gaining access, creating special relationships. I mean, this is not about, every one of these is not about gaining bases, but it's about creating those special relationships in the literal. For both China and India, of course, in the Gulf, the Americans are still there to take care of the security issues. And as we can see, the Middle East, America is tied to the Middle East, so we don't expect the Americans to leave anytime in the Middle East. But what you're seeing, beginning to see, is an expanding Indian and the Chinese interest in security partnerships with the with the Gulf countries. The Bay of Bengal is emerging as a, you know, those of you who follow what's happening in Burma, the Chinese interest in Burma, the Indian interest in Burma, the military naval dynamic has been an important part of it, and we've seen some of that play itself out. And some of my Chinese friends call the Andamans as a, again, as an island chain. I mean, the same metaphors from the Pacific being drawn in here, as an island screen that blocks Chinese access into the Indian Ocean through the Malacca Straits. And India's control of the Andamans then has emerged as a, an important component. And the Andaman Sea, which is this side of the South China Sea, and the South China Sea on the other side, have both become interesting objects where the Chinese and the Indian navies are beginning to do things in a manner in which they've not done before. In the South China Sea, it's probably just as the Chinese say, look, Indian Ocean is not Indian Ocean. Many Indians would say South China Sea is not China Sea. But the fact, of course, is China is a rising power out there. India's own interest has been to demonstrate its commitment to freedom of navigation. It's largely supported the U.S. positions. It has stepped up its defense interaction with Vietnam. It's doing more things with Indonesia, with Singapore, with a range of countries there. That India's interest and profile in the South China Sea has grown. So what you're seeing is in all the three important littorals in the Arabian Sea, Bay of Bengal, and South China Sea, an expanding activity by both the powers and the friction that it is beginning to generate. Like many Chinese friends of mine will ask, you know, what is India's interest in South China Sea? So I think similarly, a lot of Indians would say, look, why is China so keen on doing things in Bay of Bengal? But I think it's not what we say about the other. But both of them are seeing the logic of expanding their presence. But both of us also suffer from significant difficulties, in a sense, the tyranny of geography. China still has to do long lines of communication to be able to operate in the Indian Ocean. India will have similar problems doing things in South China Sea and beyond. But the aspiration, the interest, and the need to be present in these regions, there's no denying that. Then that brings me to the last two sets of issues. I mean, I think one is it's quite clear, many academics and scholars have always agreed that the India-China relationship is a security dilemma. It represents a classic security dilemma. In a sense, whatever China does raises concerns in India, and whatever India does raises concerns in China. And that the security dilemma you now see expanding and deepening into the maritime domain. Of course, from pure theory, of course, security dilemmas cannot be resolved. But in politics, of course, you have to try and find ways in which you can mitigate some of this rivalry. So I think India and China are beginning to talk about maritime security dialogues, maritime security cooperation, confidence-building measures, all the laundry lists the Americans have invented over the last 40 years, Ink Sea and all this stuff. That there are many of these lists which policymakers in both sides are figuring out, say, look, okay, there are things we can do. Let's at least find a way of talking about these issues. But the problem with power is when the two rising powers, the challenge of, it's not about CBMs alone. The CBMs, as anybody who's done arms control knows, that look, they're very useful when there is no problem between countries, but they're useless when there are real problems between countries. So I think the problem, as we've seen in the US-China case, many of the CBMs that were conceived earlier, like there is one complex maritime consultation mechanism, which didn't work when the relationship between China and India have not gone too well. They're trying to reinvent some of those things again. But the fact is, there is a structural problem in the Indian Ocean, the Pacific. The rise of the Chinese power and the emergence of India as a slow, in a more slower fashion does create a fundamental imbalance in the power structures. Now, the question is, how do we construct a different order? Can there be a construction of a new security order in this part of the world, which is stable enough, which is capable of dealing with the security concerns of all the two countries? And since the United States is the dominant power in the Indian Ocean as well as in the Pacific, what the U.S. does is going to be the principal variable in structuring a new security order in this part of the world. So therefore, and that's where we come to the intersection between the Indian policy, the Chinese policy, and the and the American strategy in these two oceans. Now, if you look at these three powers, how their interaction might shape itself. From the American case, you know, we've heard about the American pivot to Asia, the American rebalance that's being talked about. But it's not clear, if you're looking at from that side, that part of the world, is this the last word from the United States? Because just 3 years ago, the Obama administration was talking about accommodation, or strategic reassurance, G2, whatever it is, that U.S. interest in accommodating China's rise in a certain framework. Of course, it was not acceptable to the Chinese. 2 years later, we began to hear about the pivot and that the U.S. need to come into the region, the difficulties of actually working out an accommodation with China. So therefore, looking from that side, it's not clear that the current policies of the U.S. are sustainable, that the U.S. has the resources to actually do a pivot or maintain a strong presence in Asia. So therefore, those of us who are looking and saying, look, how do we think about a future balance of power in this region will have significant uncertainties in terms of where U.S. policy is headed. So what we hear today need not necessarily be policy 2 years down the road, because the American economic condition and the kind of different possibilities that it opens up. In America, that weakens too fast. Some Indians, at least, would argue, might be tempted to do a deal with the Chinese. It could be the G2 type of understanding, or it could be spheres of influence. As one Chinese admiral suggested, you stay west of Hawaii, we stay east. Give us a call when you have a problem, we'll take care of it for you. The idea of spheres of influence, I mean, you know, again, these are all bad words that have been recently abolished from the terminology. But the fact is that you have these two great powers beginning to find, jousting, because there is a fundamental tension between the rising Chinese naval power and the American forward presence in Asia. How that gets resolved is an important issue. And I think the potential solutions to that problem could vary from a confrontation and Cold War at one end to collective security on the other, but with a range of options in between, which could be condominiums, spheres of influence, you name it, various possibilities in which the U.S. policy might settle to. So that is that uncertainty is what both Chinese and Indians are betting on or calculating at. The second part of it is the ambiguities about India's policy. Of course, when we stand with the Americans, we are natural allies. We stand with the Chinese, we are for a multipolar world. It looks pretty, you know, grim in the sense we say all things to all people. But there is a difference in terms of when we talk with the Chinese of multipolar world, India would like a multipolar Asia as well, which, of course, the Chinese don't talk about a multipolar Asia. They probably would prefer a unipolar Asia. So there are, beyond the rhetoric of suggesting that there is significant commonality, how we might be in the same bed of the BRICS, but the dreams are different. And therefore, structurally for India, that on the one hand, it finds the dramatic expansion of the Chinese power and the Chinese power radiating at India from the oceans and how to deal with it. That India can deal with it either through its own efforts at home, through internal balancing, or through partnerships with other countries through external balancing. The internal balancing alone will not be enough to deal with the Chinese power. And external balancing means the question of American policies. Can we construct a relationship in which India does not become a junior partner, or India's space gets constricted by a strict alliance structure? So India's problem is then, how does it deal with the rising Chinese power without entering into a subordinate relationship with the United States? And that's where the significant challenge is in terms of designing India's policy in terms of how does it cope with the potential American weakness, the expanding Chinese strength, and the various possibilities that emerge. How does India construct a relationship with the United States? And there, I think the signals have been ambiguous. While on the one hand, our relationship with the U.S. has deepened on the defense side, there is also ambivalence about how far this relationship can go. And lastly, if you look at the Chinese, of course, the Chinese have the upper hand in this game because the Chinese have the capacity to tip the outcomes in one direction or the other. A China that accommodates the U.S. interests would attract the U.S. into a different kind of partnership. A China that might give us a boundary deal will tip India's position in a different direction. But at this point, I think the Chinese feel strong enough of not having to offer deals to either to the United States or to India. And therefore, it is the nature of the Chinese policy that how is China going to deal with its own power? What is the kind of relationships it wants to establish with the United States and India? I think that's going to set the stage for a different relationship. That brings me to the absolutely final point. I mean, that the intersection that today we are talking about between US-China-Indian policies has not really been conceived of as a normal thing. There were only two occasions in the last 100 years where our paths got crossed. One was in the Second World War. I mean, the people have it's called the Forgotten War because most people have forgotten about it. You remember the Burma-India-China theater? General Stilwell, the American general who came to India, built this road from India to China. That China was the Chinese nationalist government. And the Chinese anti-Japanese war effort was being supported from India by the Americans. That's a story that's been forgotten, that it was the American resources that came into India creating a whole structure out there to strengthen the Chinese resistance against the Japanese. I mean, that was one phase in which the three of us were seemingly on the same side. And then in the 59-62 period, when the turbulence in Tibet, at that point, the attempted construction of India-US relationship against China, that again was a short-lived one and didn't work. But this time, as China and India turn to the seas, begin to develop expansive capabilities, and I think the nature of this interaction between the three powers is going to be the decisive factor, I think, in terms of shaping the regional security order and creating a framework in which we could deal with the challenges of these two oceans. Now, the Americans have proposed an India-China-US dialogue. The Indian government has supported it, but the Chinese at this point think they're not ready for it at this point. They've not supported it. So I think at this point, I think China feels strong enough that it can deal with bilaterally both India and China, and that any kind of multilateral framework might be relevant. That's, I don't think we've heard the last word from the Chinese. But the fact is, as the maritime competition begins to unfold in the Indian and the Pacific Oceans, a whole lot of new challenges are going to come up. The security of the sea lanes, the protection of small states, the nature of the military political relationships between the three powers and the smaller states. These are all going to be issues, and how this gets conflated. And I think what we try to do in the Samudra Manthan is really to lay out a framework to begin to think about these issues. And certainly, this is not the last word, because the story, I think, of the seas, of the Samudra Manthan in the Indo-Pacific is just beginning to unfold. Thank you, Ashley.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm going to speak from here. Rather, I've got stuff spread out all over the place here trying to take notes. I want to thank Ashley very much for inviting me and for his very fulsome introduction. Truth in Advertising, some years ago we split off our China team into a separate division and it's headed by Dr. Dave Finkelstein. And he now has somewhere upwards of about 24 Mandarin speakers and readers working on China issues alone. And while the rest of us do the rest of Asia, and I'm no longer in charge of anything but myself. I've moved to the exalted position of senior fellow, and I can assure you, senior fellowdom is great. I'm allowed to do these sorts of things. Keep my schedule. I'm going to hop around a bit to talk to some of the things that Raja has addressed. About a year ago, I was flattered to be asked to be a reviewer of his manuscript and submit a report back to Carnegie whether they should go forward with publication. And I gave it a rave review at the time. I thought this was a terrific piece, and it really dug down into some of the issues and the details of what's going on between Delhi and Beijing and along the Indian Ocean littoral that is quite important. I must say, and he didn't say it as much in his text here or in his presentation here, he did refer to Admiral Alfred Thayer Mahan, but I've noticed that maybe Mohan and Mahan, I'm not sure if that's where he got his, he's going to be India's Alfred Raja Mohan. That's He indicated in his presentation that the U.S. is the dominant power in the Indian Ocean. I'm not so sure Washington agrees with that. In fact, if you look at the latest strategy document that that Washington put out, or the Department of Defense put out in January of this year, it specifically commented that it hoped and expected that India would be the net provider of security in the Indian Ocean. And clearly the U.S. strategic, at least the security strategy that it's pursuing, we've heard a lot about the rebalance, but effectively what that is it's saying we're moving away from having boots on the ground in the Middle East or in Central Asia, and over time we're going to return to a more traditional, at least in Asia, a more traditional posture of offshore. And that places great importance on naval and maritime relationships. I'm happy to report to you that the U.S. Navy and the Indian Navy has had now for the past 6 or 7 years or so a strong and continuing developing relationship, which I would argue is amongst all of the services, it's the Navy-to-Navy relationship in which we've made quite a lot of progress. Now, let me switch to some U.S. Perspective or strategic perspectives on some of the comments that were, or the premises. Clearly, I think one of the central U.S. security issues is going to be watching how the Sino-Indian rivalry actually does play out. And for some time, Burma was actually the nexus of this competition, until the Burmese government effectively mitigated the rivalry by widening the competitive playing field. NAPIDAW has transformed a bipolar competition into a multipolar framework by making enough changes in its government and in terms of its human rights posture to allow the U.S. to restore full diplomatic relations this year. And now the United States is positioned to be a player in this new framework, provided, of course, the government of Burma doesn't backslide. Now, with regard to Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, the Maldives, and the Bay of Bengal, China continues to make economic inroads, but I would argue that has not been translated into strategic leverage for Beijing. Simply, if nothing else, geography matters. Culture matters, proximity matters. All of those countries live in the shadow of India. And they're not interested, I would venture to say, in making an enemy out of India. And so no matter how impressive some of the Chinese economic developments have been, at least it's my interpretation that in all three of those countries, they still understand that they need to maintain a close strategic and security relationship with New Delhi. China, when we talk about the China-India competition, it's important, I think, to understand that China has had a problem with economic imbalance in terms of the development of the country. It's their eastern seaboard that has been the center, in fact, is the center of economic gravity in China. China's west has been slowly but surely trying to catch up. And so part of the motivations for Beijing over the past few years has been, how can we plug the west of China into the globalized world? And the best way to do that is go south. Go south to the Indian Ocean and connect that part of China to if you will, the globalized network of maritime commerce, so that trade and development, energy and what have you, can flow. So much of their development has a strong economic motivation. It is not a pretext. There is a genuine need on the part of Beijing to do economic development, and by going south. Now, China claims it has no intention of encircling India, just as the United States, it has no intention of containing China. But for many Indian security analysts, they argue that Its initiatives in Burma and Bangladesh and Sri Lanka are seen as more strategic than economic. So there you have an element of disagreement between how security analysts in both countries are looking at the scene. There's no question that China is gradually putting in place impressive naval capabilities, mainly in the Asia-Pacific theater. But it is also putting in place attendant infrastructure places along the Bay of Bengal. I think it was a Booz Allen study of almost a decade ago now who argued that they're stringing pearls, a string of pearls, the bases along the Indian Ocean littoral was all part of a giant Chinese strategic plan to one, encircle India, but two, to provide a way in which it could maritime dominance in the Indian Ocean. I think they're a long way from that. Now, but from India's perspective, it's important to understand that the Chinese counter-piracy mission, they've been doing this now for 4 years. For four straight years, there's been three PLA Navy ships on station in the Arabian Sea and the Gulf of Aden. And they've learned a lot. They've learned how to take care of themselves logistically. They've networked themselves into the infrastructure, into the diplomatic life of the region. And rather than building bases, at least according to some studies that I've done, what they're taking advantage of are the state-owned enterprises. Costco comes to mind, which has trading posts all along the Indian Ocean littoral. So the PLA Navy is able to send a message off to Beijing, who goes from the Navy to the Ministry of Transport and the Ministry of Transport back down the food chain to these Chinese trading companies, and are in fact able to have de facto logistics support taken to provide support for these Chinese ships that have been out there. And Salalah, Oman, as was mentioned, is one of the central places they put into, because that makes geographic sense. If you're trying to protect ships from piracy, you don't want to have to sail for 10 days to go replenish. You want to go to a nearby port. And Salalah, Oman, is on the Gulf of Aden. It is not inside the Persian Gulf, and it's a convenient port to do that. I think the most important long-term strategic problem associated with this nascent rivalry that is going on is the potential threat that each poses to the other's oil shipments coming from the Persian Gulf. Now, everybody knows about China's long sea line of communication all the way from the Persian Gulf through across the Indian Ocean and then through one of the straits in Indonesia, Straits of Malacca normally, and then up South China Sea to China. Long way. And so when China frets about its sea lane of communication or sea lines of communication, they often the U.S. Navy is perceived as the usual suspect who they're really talking about. But if you look at the geography of the Indian Ocean, it's India that is perfectly positioned to interdict this sea lane, both on India's west coast and on the Arabian Sea coming out of the Persian Gulf, and then all along on India's east coast, the Bay of Bengal. The Bay of Bengal, in many ways, is an Indian lake. If you look at India's east coast, it frames one side of the Bay of Bengal, and the Nicobar and Andaman Islands form the other side. And there are Indian bases there. So they're essentially sitting astride the western entrance to the Straits of Malacca. So every oil shipment goes by there is within easy range of Campbell Bay, which is their latest base, and down in the, I guess it's one of the southernmost of the Nicobar Islands. So what threat does China pose to India's sea lanes? As many of you know, India largely depended upon oil to keep its economy going, both from Africa and from the Persian Gulf. Well, obviously, if you have a Chinese squadron sitting there in the Arabian Sea, that poses a threat to that. Now, could India deal with those three ships? Absolutely. That's not an issue. But there's a Chinese aphorism that is at work here. You see the acorn but you imagine the oak tree. And Indian naval and strategic planners are looking at this PLA Navy acorn off in the Arabian Sea, and imagining a PLA Navy oak tree out there someday. And the reason they worry about that is because the PLA Navy is building ships a hell of a lot faster than the Indian Navy is, and we don't need to go into why that is so. It's a long, sad story, but nonetheless, from the point of view of the Indian Navy. But the fact is the PLA Navy is producing ships a lot and fielding new and modern ships much more rapidly. So that's an aspect of this naval relationship that we need to get to. And I think I ought to wrap up here by saying that from the U.S. interest, one of the countries that I think we need to pay particular attention to and to get ourselves involved is Sri Lanka. It deserves a special mention because, one, it's a capable partner and has had a very successful campaign against the LTTE. Obviously, there's a lot of angst and serious concern about how that terrorism campaign against the Tamil Tigers was finally wound up, and some pretty terrible things took place. But in terms of maritime issues, one of the things that not many people know about is the Sri Lankan Navy learned how to deal with suicide boat tactics from the Sea Tigers. They learned how to deal with swarm attacks and all sorts of things that they've actually been the only navy in the world that has been exposed to these kinds of threats. And you may say, well, so what? Well, where else do these threats manifest themselves? Straits of Hormuz. Think of what Iran is doing. So much of the sorts of problems that Sri Lanka and their navy dealt with over the past few years are the same sorts of problems that the United States and any other country that depends upon oil coming through there would have to confront if Iran attempted to close the Straits of Hormuz. So with that, I have not done justice to Raja's excellent work, and I think it really is the most comprehensive piece of work that I've seen in terms of looking at this rivalry in the Indian Ocean. And importantly, it should not be a surprise, it's written mainly from a point of view of India as opposed to Beijing. But nonetheless, it gives you a good basis for appreciating what's going on the ground in terms of this rivalry for both influence as well as strategic advantage.
Thank you, Mike. That was... I want to thank Admiral McDivitt and Raja for laying out, I think, the multiple dimensions of the security dilemma that is described in the book, and for flagging certain trends that only promise to make this dilemma more problematic in the years to come. This, of course, does not mean that this relationship is destined to malignant rivalry or competition that breaks out in war. But it does indicate that both sides will have to pay special attention to the perceptions of each other and consciously work towards some sort of mechanisms that allow the suspicions to be bounded rather than get out of control. I want to open the floor for comments and questions. The only request I have is when I recognize you, just identify yourself for the benefits of the speakers and keep your comments or questions focused, because I want to give both our participants here the maximum chance to address the issues you raise. Tezi? And wait for the microphone, please, because...
Thank you. Tezi Schaefer from Brookings. Wonderful presentation. I actually have a question for each of you. For Raja in particular, you were focusing mainly on the India-China-U.S. triangle. How significant are the other players in the region, the other consequential players in the region? I'm thinking in particular of Japan, but there are probably others as well, Australia, Korea, Russia, should they choose to get more deeply involved. And for the Admiral, but perhaps also for Raja, what about the west side of the Indian Ocean, where the most pressing problems today have been those of piracy? And we've had both a U.S. command, a multiplicity of U.S. commands, and a multiplicity of U.N.-related instruments. I'm trying to be as neutral as I can in how I describe that, which India has not been entirely comfortable dealing with, but of which India would be a very logical part in a well-ordered universe. How does that play out, and how does that affect what you see as the strategic outlook for the region?
I think the other players, I mean, it's not just the three of them. I mean, there are Asia-Pacific, you know, pretty large countries, Japan, Indonesia, Vietnam. These are not small countries by any stretch of imagination. I think for what one has done for the analytical purposes, really to focus on these three, because once you talk about US allies come in automatically, as Japan and Australia. And in fact, as the book will detail, in the last 10 years, once India's relationship with the U.S. has improved, India's military engagement with the U.S. has expanded, is almost simultaneously you've seen significant expansion of India-Japan maritime engagement. Now, India-Australia maritime engagement have automatically or substantially increased following the transformation of the relationship with the U.S. But the other players, in fact, the book touches on some of them, the expanding India-Vietnam relationship, for example. The Vietnamese are buying 6-kilo-class submarines. The Indians are, most probably the Indians are going to train them. That the more and more ASEAN states are looking to India, seeking greater defense cooperation. And the problem has been our capacity to deliver, not the lack of interest. That takes you back to the capability issue in Delhi, that the interest in expanding defense cooperation with India is not just coming from U.S. and its allies, but from across the region. The Indonesians, we have a defense cooperation agreement with them. Singapore, where we regularly stop and pick up supplies so that without Singapore's cooperation, India won't be able to operate in the South China Sea. So I think there are substantive relationships that are emerging between India and almost all the other nations in the Pacific. Japan, for example, just concluded a 2+2 dialogue with India. It's the only country that they do it other than Australia. Japan has a security declaration with India. Again, beyond the U.S. and Australia, the only country with which they've had this relationship. And in fact, the Indo-Pacific concept was largely the invention of Mr. Abe. Shinzo Abe is coming back. I don't know if he'll get elected, but that the confluence of the two seas as a concept was really that the Japanese see this, that they need to imagine the two oceans together. That has largely come from them. So I think the other players are going to be significant, and there'll be much competition for their winning their favors. On the piracy, I think piracy was a great excuse for the Chinese, had a good, legitimate reason to come to the Indian Ocean, demonstrate their capabilities, pick up the issues. For India, again, there was a big fight between the Navy and the Defense Ministry, because the Defense Ministry was not very enthusiastic about sending out this mission. But once they figured out the geopolitics, that look, it was important to be there. It's not that all the world's navies are going to fix the piracy problem, because the problem is on land, actually. The problem is about fixing a functioning government in Somalia. And I think things have improved. And there, I would say, beyond shared, the so-called shared awareness and other coordination areas, India has used some of this for cooperation with multilateral. And now we have agreements with China and Japan, for example. And now the Koreans are coming into it of arrangement with the convoys. We want to do things, whatever, some at least cooperation there. But more interesting, I think, is India's initiative to revive the Indian Ocean Regional, Indian Ocean Rim Association for Regional Cooperation. IORARC, that the India is trying to revive that organization, trying to create some structure of regional cooperation. Similarly, India has also taken this initiative called the Indian Ocean Naval Symposium, largely modeled on the WPNS of the US initiative, trying to bring different forms of people together. So it's not just the big power competition, but I think it needs some form of regional engagement, some form of regional cooperation. And I think India is quite open to work in multiple directions. And China, clearly, having to operate in that part of the world, is looking for any framework in which it is ready to engage other states.
We're just finishing up a report on the Arabian Sea, and certainly piracy plays a big role in it. And I'm happy to report that at least over the last 14 months or so, piracy is down dramatically. There has been improvements on land in Somalia, but it's also been a combination of improved naval coordination, and I'll get to that in a minute. But something else called best management practices that the International Maritime Organization puts out to merchant ships that sail there, and, in terms of self-protection, how to keep these pirates who are in essentially speedboats from getting aboard your ship to begin with, and then something called a citadel, which is essentially a safe house where you muster the crew up, get everybody inside, lock the door, yell for help, and hope they can't break the door down before the help gets there. And that's turned out to be really effective. But the thing that has been the crucial tipping point, if you will, or thing that has tipped the balance, has been the proliferation of privately armed security detachments. There's over 100 American and British companies that are in the business of providing armed detachments that are embarked on these merchant ships. And so far, no ship that has had an armed detachment on board has been pirated. So the good news story is piracy is, at least statistically, is going down in that part of the world. Now, the role of China in India and Russia, and Japan for that matter, all of these countries have decided for one reason or another, Japan because of constitutional issues, China and India and Russia because they didn't want to be associated with anything that smacked of either working for an American or working for the European Union or working for NATO. There is a NATO task force out there. There is a European Union task force out there. And there's something called Task Force 151, which the commander of the Fifth Fleet has organized. And so most other countries that send ships, they fall in or they're organized into one of these three task groups or task forces. But the four countries I mentioned have essentially been independent players. But their efforts are all coordinated. And this is, Raja mentioned something called SHADE, S-H-A-D-E, shared awareness and blah, 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 whatever it is. They meet, periodically in Bahrain to organize and plan. But also, just a few months ago, though, these four countries have also agreed to work with one another. So we have the Chinese and the Indian Navy ostensibly working with one another and taking turns providing the, if you will, the command and control or the organization for these convoys of merchant ships that come out of the Bab el-Mandab at the end of the Red Sea and transit across the Gulf of Aden. And so, in fact, what you have is common interests. It's easy for navies to work together when you have common interests, in this case, counter-piracy. So there is a basis for understanding. It's important to understand that the PLA Navy, the 4 years of operations has been a battle laboratory for them. This has been a learning experience for them, and they've been exposed to operations in and around the great navies, all of the great navies of the world. And they've learned their lessons, and so they're getting quite professional. And I might add the South Koreans have too. This is the first time the South Koreans have sent ships halfway around the world and kept them on station for months at a time. And so the participation there does improve the professionalism of navies that are often just operate in regional or local waters. The idea of you have to send ships out there and then keep them there for several months. The longest deployment of the PLA Navy is 9 months. That's longer than most U.S. Navy ships deploy for. So it's quite impressive.
Thank you. Satu?
Yes, thank you. Satu LeMay from the East-West Center. Thank you for both of the wonderful talks. My question is, if I understand correctly, on the 2009 Maritime Doctrine, India's Maritime Doctrine, there are primary seas and secondary seas, and South China Sea and Red Sea are characterized as secondary. I wonder if you could say something about what's behind the categorization, because you identify South China Sea as one of the three main subregions of your book. Second, you talked about the Vietnam possible training for the Kilo class. As you know, your Minister of Defense was in Indonesia, and an agreement has been signed to pick up some Navy cooperation there. Can you talk a little bit about that and whether India's training increases as Southeast Asians buy Russian things, which India is well-versed in, but not if they buy non-Russian things? Does your scope for training Southeast Asian navies decline?
Yeah. I think on the primary and the secondary seas, I mean, I think it's a fairly straightforward geography thing, right? The further it is away from you, it's more difficult to operate. That India sits in a very advantageous position in the Indian Ocean, and that its first priority must be one to consolidate its own position. That in your near seas, you try and consolidate your own position. For example, the kind of things we're doing with Sri Lanka and Maldives. I mean, there is a triangular coordination mechanism where joint exercises, sharing, MDA, maritime domain awareness. We're doing a lot of things, despite all the other problems. Geography there does compel for us to act together. So the secondary seas are those which are some distance away, where just as China has to come into the Indian Ocean through the Malacca Straits, India has to go there through the Malacca Straits to South China Sea. So the argument some people are making that, look, India must stand up to the Chinese and take them on, or some people see India's presence there as a counter-containment. If China is trying to encircle India, India is going to encircle China in South China Sea. Some of that is quite far-fetched. I mean there's no way India can unilaterally act in the South China Sea, because it's one thing to show flag, it's one thing to show, you know, do exercises, but it's entirely another to have operational capability. Some people have talked about, you know, Vietnam eventually will give India a base, and therefore India can deploy its ships. Even then, it's not even going to be a tiny fraction of the American military presence. So I think what it is the American presence that is a decisive factor in the Western Pacific. India is not going to change it fundamentally. But India does give, say, diplomatic support. When India joins the call of the rest of the ASEAN, or at least those who are talking about it, the Americans, and say, look, freedom of the navigation is an issue, it lends some diplomatic weight. So in the secondary area, there are things that India can do that are not, in a sense, directly projecting power, but to act as a diplomatic and other supportive structure for those who are seeking some way of dealing with the rise of the Chinese power. In terms of in fact, India has trained the Singaporean crews. And Singapore doesn't have Russian submarines. Because I think India can't sell arms because it doesn't have too many. It doesn't make too many. But its capacity to train, I think, is a significant one. And I think most navies are really starting up. Mainly the submarine arms are really, it's a new thing. Most of them are beginning to construct. So therefore, I think India's strength is in training. And that as a generic thing that India can provide to the Southeast Asians. The problem, again, is the slow, if you think, Indians are slow, you should know the Japanese are slower, the Indonesians are even slower. Right? So I think the aspiration to do things together, that's why there are declarations between India and Australia. India and Indonesia goes back to 2005. But I think finally they took 3 years to get their parliament approved the proposal. So I think we are moving slowly, but I think everyone is beginning to, last 2 years, the transformation that has occurred is people are there's much greater urgency to find partners. So in that sense, India does fit in the bill, but it is not there in providing arms, but training, MDA, those kind of areas where actually India can work quite closely with the Southeast Asian countries.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Jeff Dyer from the Financial Times. Thank you very much for two fascinating presentations. You both talked about Sri Lanka, about Burma, Andaman Islands, Oman. Neither of you talked about Pakistan and port at Gwadar. I wonder if there have been all sorts of reports and comments from various Pakistani officials about the prospect of a Chinese base there. Is this just a bit of a bluff, or if you could tell us what your thoughts are on that, is there something more serious going on there?
You have intelligence on this?
I, I probably am not the last person I want to be talking about Gwadar, but China, a Chinese trading company, agreed foolishly, in my opinion, to take over the management of Gwadar. It's a bit of a white elephant right now. It's a port with very little infrastructure connecting it to anywhere else. And it's also in Baluchistan, which has its own endemic stability problems there. So even if you do build roads and rails from Gwadar to try to distribute goods either north all the way through Pakistan into China or everywhere to Iran or to India, you have problems there. But in terms of, is it a place that the PLA Navy could use? Yeah, probably. I think they've discovered that there's lots of places that they can use over the past 4 years. And so I'm not sure that Gwadar is of any particular central strategic importance to the PLA Navy. Is it a place where they could go get fuel and food and have a safe place to put their sailors ashore so they to get off the ship and have a little liberty and things like that? But it's fairly limited right now, and it remains to be seen if it turns into anything other than the white elephant that it is right now.
Just agree with the Admiral. I think Gwadar has been a bit of a red herring.
White elephant or red herring, whatever, you know. That's
that if actually, you know, what all of us armchair said, you know, easy to draw lines and say, look, here is Gwadar, is going to connect to Kashgar and Urumqi and you can draw a pipeline, you can do a railway line and all that. But, you know, it's in a lousy place. There is no infrastructure. It's on a small island connected to the mainland through one thin reed, which can be bombed out of shape by one run by the American Navy's bombers. So it's not a great place. So I think the Gwadar, because the initial construction of the String of Pearls focused on the new ports that China was building, which included Hambantota, which has come. Again, it's not a thriving port at this point. But the U.S. Intelligence community has done a study on where is the Chinese Navy has actually been calling. Because after all, since December 2008, they've been operating in the Gulf of Aden. Which are the places they've called in? Then you get a different, interesting picture than the String of Pearls of the original construct, which had, Chittagong. And, you know, why would anybody want to go up Chittagong is a mystery to me. But the fact is, you have Hambantota, you have, Gwadar and drawn up. But if you look at the Chinese Navy, where is it called? It's a very interesting place, Singapore. Which makes eminent sense because it's the first port of call. You stop and pick up, and Singaporeans can't say no to the Chinese, just as Oman can't say no to them. So Singapore. Second is Colombo, which is in a functional, decent port, efficient port, so you pick up stuff from there. Karachi. In fact, Karachi and Salela, these were the four places where the American... Djibouti is open. Anyone, even the Japanese have a base there now. They're asking anyone who can pay to come and set up a base. Now, Karachi, I think, is far more interesting. Because Karachi is the place where the Pakistani Navy is deployed. Karachi is also the place where, it's again U.S. intelligence sources, the Chinese have developed a fairly expansive engineering workshops for naval maintenance. And since... China is building new frigates for Pakistan, which are going to be deployed in Karachi. Having an engineering facility there actually works much more nicely for the Chinese, that if they're looking for a facility, there is a full-fledged Pakistani naval facilities, and if they want to use that, and I'm sure the all-weather relationship accommodates that. So I don't think, so Gwadar in that sense is a red herring. The real story is in Karachi.
There's also a dimension of different players involved in the decisions pertaining to China's maritime activities. And so the institutions that are involved in the choices China makes with respect to its naval operations are not necessarily the same that are involved in commercial operations. Right. And so many of the activities in the Indian Ocean area are driven by simple profit-making desire for profit making rather than strategic components. But there was a lady out there, let me give her a chance.
Thank you. I'm Namrata Goswami. I'm with the United States Institute of Peace. So, Raja, from your presentation, what I heard is that there is the possibility of intense rivalry for influence or possibility of escalation in the Indian Ocean region. Now, in that context, you also argued that the United States could be the only player that could provide a security architecture. So I'm interested to know from you what that architecture would be like. So besides containment or balancing, what else could the United States bring in to make that architecture in a way that actually de-escalates the conflict?
The U.S. already has the architecture in place. It is a four-letter word called the Navy. Look, the U.S. has dominated the Pacific. The U.S. Navy was the only force in being out there that has kept whatever, the order, peace, whatever you want to call it. And in the Indian Ocean, once the British left east of the post-East of Suez policy, the Americans largely replaced the British in the Indian Ocean. So they already exist. The problem is not lack of order. That's not what I was saying. The existing order is being undermined by the rise of China, you know, without passing any value judgment. That the rise of the Chinese power in the Pacific fundamentally contradicts the forward presence of the American Navy out there for the last, starting from late 1898 when they went to Philippines, and since then, Second World War, etc. So it's said that Comrade Mao Zedong once said, look, the Americans are snoring next to our bed, we got to live with it, but someday we're going to tell them, knock, knock, would you move a bit, please? So as the Chinese muscle expands, the capacity to nudge the Americans, that is what's beginning to happen in the Pacific. So the question is, how do you adjust to the new situation? Does the U.S. do air-sea battle, in a sense? Does it develop the capacity to penetrate through the Chinese defenses? Or does it fall back away from the ranges of the Chinese land-based and other missiles? That is the strategy U.S. is debating. So that's on the military side. Similarly, on the Indian Ocean, that China has never been present there. The Americans have largely run the security arrangements. So now the question is, how does the U.S. Distribute its resources in the context of what's happening in the Pacific? One way of imagining it is, if you see this as an integrated place, they might have more options, more partners. That is one way of looking. So the challenge is that in the context of the shifting structure of military power in this part of the world, one is, how do you create a new military balance? Second is, what kind of a political order where you, some sense of a common shared things you can develop. I mean, at this point, both are works in progress. I mean, I think the American military doctrine is, and strategic doctrine is, a work in progress. The prospect of constructing an order is, again, there's no agreement. Forget order at this point. The existing legal arrangements are being challenged. Look, at a time when Asia's trade in the world is dramatically expanded, the waters of Asia today do not accept the law of the sea. That the law of the sea, which is supposed to be the principal document to define the rules of conduct, there, Chinese don't accept the law of the sea when it comes to their territorial disputes. And the Americans and the Chinese are arguing about the meaning of military navigation in exclusive economic zones. So the principal legal instrument, I'm not arguing the Americans have not signed it. I mean, that's really irrelevant whether the Americans sign it or not. The problem is the core interpretation of a body of laws that was crafted in a different age, when Asia was asleep, when Asia didn't, you know, was looking more at territorializing, expanding territorial sovereignty, rather than focused on keeping sea lanes open. That document today is under contestation. So I think there are big troubles out there that in Asia's waters, there's no understanding on the basics today. And at the source of it is the rise of the Chinese power and what it does to the American position. So I think the work that needs to be done, it's how do we construct at least a minimal set of norms so that this region's commerce, which is now the world's lifeline, how does it work? What are the rules under which the militaries can operate? How do you resolve territorial disputes? I think everything is up in the air. So this is going to be the story, I think, for a long time. So you don't see an order coming anytime soon, but we're not even having serious talks between the contending players.
Can I? I think that was an important question. Can I ask you a follow-up on that? It seems to me that the issue of presence per se is not the problem, because the oceans are commons. I mean, anyone can operate anywhere, and the U.S. may have the power, but it does not have a proprietary prerogative about who operates in any ocean. The issue is behavior, is it not? And it's behavior linked ultimately to some assessment of political intentions. If there are problematic behaviors, then that's where I think there is the need to create rules that would either limit those behaviors or shape them in directions that are appropriate. And the whole question of intentions, why are they there? If the intentions are purely to do what navies do as a matter of course, that's one thing. But then the issue becomes your security dilemma. And I think that's really where the uncertainties come, when navies begin to operate in parts of the world that they historically did not operate. It, I think, raises questions about what their long-term intentions are and what that signifies. And I think that is perhaps where there is most uncertainty. Rather than simply presence per se, I think we have to be careful not to conflate the presence necessarily with instability. Mike, you want to?
I just want to say a word on the issue of security architecture, because you mentioned that specifically. It's my impression that India is fiercely non-aligned and is not interested in, at least in the near term, in being captured in any sort of formal security architecture. So I'm not sure what Raja is talking about, but I can certainly agree, I can appreciate a security architecture which is based upon understanding and that everybody shares agreed upon rules and norms and that sort of thing. But in terms of, if you're thinking security architecture in terms of treaties and what have you, I don't think that's in the cards for the Indian Ocean.
I think both of us, you know, so Admiral is on the Southeast Asian circuit. I mean, so am I. I lived there for 3 years. I mean, architecture is something that comes out of your ears if you live in that part. But the talk has never been matched by substance. And I think the talk about architecture, look, Indian government says we are for an open, inclusive architecture. When they say inclusive, this is saying keep the Americans in. When the Chinese say we want an Asian architecture, keep the Americans out. So I think they don't even agree on the terms of how to construct. But there is talk in Asia. And I think what we're seeing today is the problem is not the presence in a sense. I mean, that the Chinese were willing to acquiesce in the American presence, even after the conflicts in Kumamoto or Taiwan, because it suited them at that point. When the Japanese, when the Americans say, look, we are a power there, we are a cap on the bottle, the Japanese bottle. For the Chinese who are willing to live with American military presence, as long as it served their interests, and later they were partners with the United States. But today, rising China finds the American presence and its alliances uncomfortable, constrains its freedom of action. Therefore, its objective is to change that structure. I mean, that's one part of it in terms. The other part is that the Chinese claims on historical basis, like the claims today on South China Sea are about historical claims, not on the basis of legality, and they're not willing to submit themselves to a legal settlement. So I think that is the problem, and I think it's really about, I mean, somebody now talks about Chinese now talking about a Monroe Doctrine, just as the U.S. Dealt with the outside powers. What China is doing is largely similar. Therefore, what might have seemed okay some time ago, now the question is how do you limit the exercise of the American power on waters close to your share? I mean, that is the issue.
Teddy? Excuse me, I noticed this is...
Oh, sorry. Our identities are interchangeable, it's okay.
It's very nice to meet you, Professor Raja Mohan. I have been learning from your works for these more than 10 years. Yeah. It's very nice to meet you again here. You already mentioned to Japan's issue. I'd like to ask your wisdom, your views on Japan's territorial issue with China.
That's what they call
this year.
That's what they call a
taking your name of the book, Japan went across the Rubicon River, and so that means Japan's government decided to purchase the Senkaku Island from the landowners. But it's I think it we opposed very strongly, and now it is very controversial now how to solve this issue. For example, we have idea of ICJ, International Court of Justice. We take it, and then so then if China accepts, so then we have a litigation of the court. But it's another Rubicon River. So I'm asking myself, whether we need such a clear cut answer, black or white. But it's a. I'd like to ask your India's. Wisdom. We had the wisdom from Deng Xiaoping about this issue that we need to make it ambiguous. So then, that is in since the 1970s. But so now, we have been suffering with the narrow sight nationalism, both countries, and very internal nationalism. But I'd like to ask you, India has been talking with China territorial issues for a long time, and you have been neighboring country of China for these 1,000 years. So I'd like to ask your views through your experience of territorial issues with China.
I would defer to Admiral who sailed those waters, and there are people in the audience who know more about Japan, and Sathu is sitting here. I think our experience is not going to be of great help to anyone, actually, because the Chinese normally say, look, India is the only one which has not solved their land boundary disputes. So we were kind of look like the sole exception. But once you put the maritime picture, now we're in a different phase. I think sometimes ambiguity is better than clarity. Partly when, like what Deng Xiaoping said the same thing to us. Look, leave some of these problems inherited from history. Let's do other things. Let's build cooperation so that you leave that ambiguous. Someday, the next generation can solve it. But I think, as you rightly said, there is today a stronger nationalism in China. That the Chinese, for example, didn't use the word South Tibet for Arunachal Pradesh, which it claims. But in the last 2 years, they started using the term South Tibet. So I think there is a sense of territorial nationalism, and I think India is no exception to that. So our experience has been, look, we've not been able to solve it, with repeated efforts, 65 years. So I think the problems are going to be much deeper in your part, not because the complexity of the issue. Look, I think when the balance of power changes, the negotiating positions change. That it is not about there is a technical solution to between two competing negotiating positions, which diplomats who are well paid can solve the problem. The problem is when balance of power changes, that you have a new circumstance. I think the problem for Japan is that the Chinese power is rising, its capacity to assert in the islands disputed has increased, and the question about American alliance commitment, whether U.S. should put its own neck on the line to defend a few islands. I mean, I think it opens up a whole new set of issues. So this is not about territorial dispute. This is about, finally, about how do you deal with rising Chinese power? Is there a way of accommodating Chinese interests in a way that this benefits the whole region? I think that is it's a political strategic issue.
KP? K.P. Nair from The Telegraph. Raja, you made a passing reference to the IOR arc. There are some other organizations, too, which have come up in response to the maritime challenges, both economic and military. BIMSTEC comes to one's mind. In a sense, the ARF is also partially a response to some of these challenges. Can you talk a little more about these organizations, the role of these organizations in maritime diplomacy? Have they become mere talking shops? BIMSTEC and IORARC, for example,
Are they just products of I.K. Gujral's fancy, which have become comatose since he went out of office?
I think ARC was half dead. You couldn't really push it. So we're trying to revive it now, because I think it's again, when the ideas first came, India was suspicious. Look, the Australians are using this to do something. India was still in a defensive mode. But now India sees that, look, it needs a regional cooperation. That's why when the ministers met last year in Bangalore, now India has taken the initiative to strengthen this organization and looking for ideas of how do we, and the Americans want to join in. I think Indians have supported the American interest in joining this organization. Similarly, the IONS, which is again a new Indian initiative, Indian Ocean Naval Symposium. Again, seeing the levels of the naval chiefs, let's try and bring people together. Because I think our stakes have risen and there's a recognition of those stakes. That's in the Indian Ocean. But on the Pacific side, the ARF has been there for a long time. It is a talk shop. I mean, it can't do much. There is East Asia Summit now, where actually in the last two summits, we're going to see next one, what the Americans and the Chinese are going to do at the summit. But the last one was pretty dramatic. So the maritime issues are coming up, but I don't see there is much possibility at this point of time, given the profound differences in terms of between the Americans and the Chinese on the one side, on a range of issues, between China and its maritime neighbors. And you saw what happened at ASEAN summit, where Cambodia was not even willing to get a chairman's statement. So I think the problem is more acute in the Pacific, because the assertion of the Chinese power is breaking up even the pretense, the ASEAN, we love the Asians, love this, the process, the dressing it up in declarations. Even that has become difficult. So I think it's a very difficult moment for the region.
Do you want to say something to that?
Part of the rebalance strategy that has not received much publicity is based upon the notion that the U.S. has to show up in the region. And that's why President Obama showed up at the East Asia Summit. That's why the administration signed on to the Treaty of Amity and Cooperation. And despite all of the naysayers who said, oh my God, you'll never get the president to come to Asia twice during a year for either the ARF or now the EAS, whether that continues in the next term, whoever is the president, remains to be seen. But at least the administration believes that it's very important that these regional institutions, be they talk shops or not, that the Washington show up, have its say, have a place at the table, and make sure its vision and its ideas and its policies are addressed. So. Well, I think the jury's still out. I'm not as pessimistic as you are.
Did you raise your hand? Yeah.
Brian Chow, Defense Group, Inc. and Wikistrat. Historically, it's been quite difficult for continental states to build up naval power. And my understanding is that China's greatest national security concern, or rather, the greatest national security concern to the Communist Party is internal stability, and that India's single greatest national security concern is actually Pakistan. So my question to the panel is, what prospects do you see of inward and landward concerns slowing or halting in some way negatively affecting each country's naval development, and therefore the bilateral naval balance and a potential security dilemma?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think the problem is these things don't happen in sequences. I mean, like in the U.S. case, I mean, where the U.S. expanding from coast to coast in the 19th century, and Teddy Roosevelt shows up and says, look, the U.S. must now look outward, and Mahan shows up at the same time and says, look, now the U.S. must build a navy. That the territorial consolidation was done. The U.S. is the number one industrial power. Therefore, the U.S. needs to go out into the world. Now, in the Chinese case and the Indian case, it's more complicated, because the problem for the China, the internal stability is the main issue. The idea that, look, the Communist Party, if the fields, look, they're sufficiently in control. But I don't see anybody making the case today that either Tibet or Xinjiang are going to separate anytime soon, that the Chinese capacity to control is fairly large. But meanwhile, the economy is globalized. If your resources have to come from far away. So the logic of the Chinese economic growth, I think, has created a new basis for naval power. And the fact that it does not face a significant threat from Russia on the continental side. All the tribes have been, you know, all the barbarians have been integrated. The far-flung regions have been connected. So you turn to the seas and you see, look here, where you're still struggling against the straitjacket imposed by the American presence, and you begin to say, look, we need to create space here. So I think I have no problem understanding the Chinese logic. I think to argue that, look, they shouldn't do this or they will only do this later, I think is denying, look, the Chinese have a great power aspiration, period. And I think it's not a unnatural aspiration. I think it's a natural aspiration. The problem for us, I think, in the Chinese case, now, if we say, look, structurally is inevitable that the Chinese are going to build a new naval capability, how do we find an accommodation? How do we limit confrontation? That is the challenge. Not questioning, look, is it a right thing or a wrong thing? Not passing judgment. Because I think the Chinese are doing what every other great power did before. And India, with all its internal problems, like you would say, look, Indians want to unite the subcontinent. When Indians talk about, what is it, the strategic unity of the subcontinent, it's essentially meaning, look, I must undo the consequences of partition, where India got divided at a time and China got united. That those problems have persisted. While you do that, you're not going to say, I'll only do this and not anything else.
I'll take one last... Let me weigh in there. Continental states that have traditionally had difficulty becoming a maritime power, the reason for that, of course, is quite simple. They shared a border with another strong power, and so their primary strategic focus was on defending themselves against a strong land power. In the case of China, that does not pertain. Right now, with the exception of India, and they have peaceful coexistence, but they've reconciled all their outstanding border disputes with all of their neighbors, the other 13 or 12 countries that they share a border with. And all of their outstanding security issues are maritime in nature. Taiwan's a maritime problem. Its claims in the East China Sea and the South China Sea is a maritime problem. Defending the east coast of China from attack from the sea is a maritime problem. Its sea lines of securing its sea lines of communication, that's a maritime problem. So if you're sitting in Beijing thinking about what are your strategic problems that you have to solve, the answer is they're all maritime in nature. And so building a defensive anti-axis area denial makes perfectly good sense. And you have Chinese interests around the world now and Chinese citizens that need to be protected. 850,000 Chinese, I read somewhere the other day, are abroad right now working. And so it's just natural. They're going feet wet. They're becoming a maritime power.
I'm going to take one last question before we break, and I'll give the chance to Nilanthi.
Nilanthi Samarnaika, CNA. Raja, I wanted to know if you could comment on Seychelles. And to pick up on your point, is this a red herring? There's been a lot of media attention devoted to Seychelles in the past year, converging interest on the part of the Chinese. They were invited for military presence, you know, quote unquote. U.S. Interest in Seychelles, though we saw the drone base there. And of course, deep Indian ties to the Seychelles Coast Guard. So I just wanted to know if you could comment on that and about the outlook for the country.
I think it's, as they say in business, location. Pakistan is very conscious of their location. They know how to play it. And I think the Seychelles are smart, actually, that they understand their location and everybody else, I mean, is beginning to understand their location. I mean, my interest, you know, got into Seychelles when President Hu Jintao showed up there in 2005 after a long visit in Africa to spend another 2 days in a country of 85,000 people. I mean, he was not just going there for, you know, to sun himself on the beaches, and the Chinese don't do that. And they do it only in Baidahe, wherever. And the second, 2 years later, he does a second trip to Africa. This time he stops in Mauritius at the end of the trip. So I think if you look at Chinese, if you're sitting in China and say, look at the map of the Indian Ocean, look, I mean, these are interesting places. And it's very interesting, when Shanghai Expo took place, Hu Jintao receives very few leaders out there. And one of the few he receives is the president of Mauritius, the president of Seychelles, or the president of, Sri Lanka. I mean, here was tiny little islands getting the special attention of the Chinese president. I mean, who doesn't have give time of the day to countries of this size? But the fact is, there is a political purpose. I mean, and I think it's logical. I mean, I think the Chinese have entertained the Indian Ocean Island, both as part of the Africa summits. Seychelles president has visited China at least 4 times in the last 2 years. And he's also come to India 3 times. And every time he comes, we give even a more ringing joint statement, we're going to do more. And if the Seychelles have played the Americans and the Russians before, during the Cold War, both the navies were interested in having stuff out there. It's nothing new for them to say, look, give me more. I think the Chinese and the Indians are willing pawns now, if you look at the importance of the location, to when the Seychelles president shows up, Delhi pays attention. So I think it's the logic of their condition, that they've been pretty good at it. And I think the size of a country of 85,000 people, their exclusive economic zone would be millions of square kilometers. So I think it's like just as Djibouti is doing today, the Japanese have a base, the Russians have a base. They say, look, all are welcome, come and pay and do stuff here if you want to. So I think for small countries, non-alignment, something we invented. I mean, I think everybody knows how to play that game. So I think it's in their interest to open up.
Well, on that note, I'm going to thank both Raj and Mike for a very stimulating afternoon. I want to thank all of you for having come by. Thank you. Well deserved. There are books behind in case you'll choose to buy your Christmas gifts early. And Raj has even agreed to sign a few of those. So thank you very much for coming. Bye-bye.